From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. This week's view takes a look at several publications dealing with cardiovascular care of children, including developments in the world of congenital heart disease. First, we'll review a recent study published in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology that looks at the maternal and fetal outcomes of the use of anticoagulation in patients with mechanical heart valves. Next, we'll go over another study in JACC which compares the surgical and catheter-based treatments over a long-term Danish study on children with congenital heart disease in that country. A third study we'll look at in JACC investigates longitudinal outcomes of patients who have a single ventricle and have received a Fontan procedure. Finally, I'll have a couple of comments for you on the American Heart Association's recently published scientific statement on CPR in adults and children who have mechanical circulatory support. So let's start with a paper looking at maternal and fetal outcomes of anticoagulation in pregnant women who have mechanical heart valves. As you know, this is a vexing problem, concerns about risk both with the fetus as well as with the mother, and it's a difficult area to study. This was an article which really asked the question, what are the risks of various types of anticoagulation strategy in women who have pregnant heart valves? It was a meta-analysis of 18 publications which compared four different strategies. First, a vitamin K antagonist throughout pregnancy. Second, low molecular weight heparin throughout pregnancy. Third, low molecular weight heparin for the first trimester, followed by a vitamin K antagonist for the last two-thirds of the pregnancy. And the fourth option, unfractionated heparin for the first trimester, followed by a vitamin K antagonist for the rest. As you know, the concern has been about the use of warfarin in the first trimester and the possibility of fetal defects caused by that agent. This study actually included 800 pregnancies from 18 publications. If we look at the maternal risk, it was lowest with the vitamin K antagonist, the overall risk 5%, compared to 16% for low molecular weight heparin, similar amount for low molecular weight heparin plus vitamin K antagonist, and similarly for unfractionated heparin. The composite of fetal risk was higher with the vitamin K antagonist, 39%, compared to 13 to 34% with the other three strategies. But the numbers were small and the confidence limits were pretty large. Interestingly, this particular study found no significant difference in fetal risk when you compared individuals who were taking less than or equal to 5 milligrams of warfarin a day versus those on higher dose regimens. So the authors of this paper concluded that the use of a vitamin K antagonist throughout pregnancy was associated with the lowest risk of adverse maternal outcomes. And it appeared that low molecular weight heparin use perhaps had the lowest risk in terms of adverse fetal outcomes. Now, I guess one thing to say for sure is that the article is somewhat reassuring that low doses of warfarin, less than or equal to 5 milligrams per day, appear to be a very safe choice in women who have mechanical heart valves. And this is really validating because this also happens to be the recommendation from the ACC AHA guideline on this topic. Clearly, we need more information and more studies to further define the fetal risk, but for the moment, I found this to be a useful article in reconfirming the potential use of warfarin, particularly low dose, in women who have mechanical heart valves and are pregnant. So let's switch gears from there, and we'll talk about the Danish study. Nationwide health registries have been very helpful for tracking progress in the evaluation and management of various types of cardiovascular disease. And in this week's JACC, there was a wonderful paper from the Danish National Registry of Patients, which identified over 9,300 children who were evaluated for and treated for congenital heart disease from 1977 until 2015. This paper was just great. And the value of a registry like this really is great in terms of helping us look at trends over time. This study looked at about 9,300 patients who underwent over 1,100 cardiac surgeries and 1,800 catheter-based therapies. The mean age from first procedure, as you might expect, as we've gotten better, decreased from the average of 3.4 years in the beginning, 1977 to 1988, to more recently, much younger age, 0.6 years old from 2003 to 2015. Most of the patients in this registry were born preterm, as you might expect. Catheter-based interventions really were not recorded, of course, before 1990, but they became increasingly important as the initial procedure in 5.8% of patients in period 2, and in period 3, which was 2003 to 2015, a significant percentage of patients had a catheter-based procedure done first. Reassuringly, over time in Denmark, the 30-day survival for children with congenital heart disease increased steadily from 97% during the first period to 98% to 100% in period 3, which again is the latest, 2003 to 2015. If we dig a little bit deeper and ask ourselves what was going on with the therapies, the first thing to notice as we look at the types of diagnoses in the Danish registry, most of them had a simple diagnosis, about 58 to 9%, and this included most commonly a VSD, a patent ductus, an ASD, or a coarctation. About 34% or so had a complex diagnosis, and this included most commonly transposition of the great arteries, tetralogy of Fallot, AV canal defect, or a univentricle physiology, each with about 5 to 8% of the total. If we look at the procedures, in particular in the last period of time study, 2003 to 2015, PDA closure represented 26% of the procedures, ASD closure and fenestration about 16%, balloon stentor dilation, particularly of the pulmonary artery or one of the branches in about 14%, pulmonary balloon valvotomy in about 11%, and balloon or stent dilation of the coarctation or the arch in about 10%. Interestingly, in Denmark, when this study began, there were roughly five centers that were treating patients with complex congenital heart disease. And more recently, that number has winnowed down. And I think the country clearly is doing a good job in focusing high-end care for these children with various types of congenital heart disease. Certainly is a nice example of how registry science helps us track progress in terms of treatment and outcomes for rare diseases like congenital heart disease. Okay, I'm going to move from that paper to another one, which is a recent study looking at longitudinal outcomes of patients with a single ventricle who've had a Fontan procedure. This was a cross-sectional study of a large number of patients, 546, who had undergone exercise testing, echocardiography, BNP evaluation, functional health assessment, and so forth. And this was repeated 9.4 years after the original study. As I mentioned before in this podcast, the ability to study large numbers of patients with rare diseases really requires investigative centers to work together. And this is a nice example of that published just recently in JACC. So there were 546 people in the original cohort, 466 were recontacted. About 54 subjects, 10%, had either received a transplant or died during the follow-up. The cumulative complication rate after the Fontan at about 9 years was a catheter intervention in 62%, the need for additional surgery in 32%, an arrhythmia requiring treatment in 32%, some type of thrombotic episode in 12%, and a dreaded complication, protein losing enteropathy in about 8%. Over time, the maximum VO2 on a stress test decreased. The ejection fraction dropped a bit from 58% to 55%. And the quality of life survey suggested that there was a decreased exercise performance about 9 years after the initial evaluation. One of the concerns in the study was the insidious nature of disease progression, where patients seem to have a decline in maximum VO2 and systemic ventricular ejection fraction. We really don't have a lot of data about how we can work on trying to avoid this type of disease progression. But certainly efforts to maximize formal exercise programs, maintain ideal body weight, obviously managing blood pressure and other risk factors, represent one avenue of trying to approach this with our patients. There's no doubt that we need more data and longer follow-up in patients like this to get a better feel for kind of the overall spectrum. But I think this paper is very useful in looking at the natural history, in quotes, of what happens to patients who have single ventricle treated with a Fontan procedure. So I'm going to finish with a very interesting report that came out of the American Heart Association. It's a scientific statement on cardiopulmonary resuscitation approaches to adults and children with mechanical circulatory support. And as you know, the number of patients in our country who are getting mechanical support as a bridge is up, but also as a destination therapy, and more subjects are living lives out there with a mechanical support device. Because of the unique characteristics of how these work, the physical findings that might be present in a typical cardiac arrest may not be in this type of patient who has a continuous flow device. So a couple of thoughts. First of all, clinical findings like skin color and capillary refill are reasonable predictors of the presence of adequate flow and perfusion. This is especially true in individuals who have mechanical circulatory support pulseless status. Also, there's something called waveform capnography, which measures and displays the partial pressure of end-tidal carbon dioxide in exhaled air. This is used to track respirations in patients undergoing mechanical ventilation, but it also can be used to track perfusion in patients in whom the more common physical findings used to assess adequate perfusion are not reliable. In this report, PET CO2 value less than 20 millimeters of mercury in an unresponsive, properly intubated, pulseless patient who has an LVAD would seem to be a reasonable indicator of poor systemic perfusion and should prompt a rescuer to initiate chest compressions. Pulse oximetry can be used in patients with an LVAD, but the results may not be as accurate as they would be normally because of the lack of pulsatile flow in this circumstance. Also, there's consensus that if an LVAD is definitively confirmed to be present and a patient has no signs of life, that bystander CPR, including chest compressions, should be recommended by emergency medical dispatchers for patients like this. If there is inadequate perfusion or unresponsiveness or an altered mental state, then the VAD should be assessed for function by looking or listening for alarms, listening for a VAD hum over the left chest or the left upper abdomen, to also ensure connections to the controller and make sure there's adequate power for the VAD. Currently, we think it's probably reasonable to provide standard post-arrest care for these victims, including mild therapeutic hypothermia, and where appropriate, consideration of early percutaneous coronary intervention in a patient who may have had an acute coronary occlusion. One thing's for sure, we need to have a standard across the VAD and total artificial heart centers that should supply necklaces or bracelets to patients who receive mechanical circulatory support devices. This should include the device type, the center contact information, and the patient's advance directives. I thought this was an interesting article and also is in the realm of patients who have particularly dangerous left heart disease at a young age and would fit with this week's theme looking at children's heart disease. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from acc.org, all of which can be found on the American College of Cardiology's website. You can find us online or wherever you get your podcast. And I look forward to sessions in the future with you. Thank you very much.